Okay, everyone, it's 9:01, so we're starting this semester's classes. It's been a while. I see we have 17 participants. Of course, as I've mentioned many times, we have many more who listen not live, so I'll respond sometimes to questions from them as well. I'm not sure if most of the names are familiar here, even some in Israel, so you guys are up pretty early. If just for the people who are new, if you have questions, I basically, the last 10 minutes I stop and there's questions or comments that can be typed in at the bottom. I also, because it's been so long and people have sent me comments and other things, there's a lot I want to get to, pick up on things mentioned in previous classes, but I'm not going to do that. I'll do that maybe at the end of today. Normally I start each class at the beginning with this, but today I just want to start, get right into it, and go for about 45, 50 minutes. This is the third class on Rabbi Yochanan Wasserman, very important figure. If you haven't heard the first two, I recommend going to the Torah in Motion website and you can download them there. You can buy a monthly pass if you want to miss pick up what we missed off. Before I start, I just want to say that Rabbi Jake Hellman is also online with us now, and I don't know if he has access to a microphone, if he just wanted to say something to welcome people. I'm not sure if he can, but I just wanted to give him the opportunity for before we began. So, Rabbi Kelman, if I don't hear you,
I'm
I'll
going to
assume
try.
that you can't.
Hello.
You don't have access to a mic. We hear you.
Okay. So welcome everybody, and a pleasure to have you after a little bit of a hiatus. And anything, we're here to help. And that's all I really want to say is welcome, and I will let Mark take over. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, and I hope that I sound a bit better than Rabbi Kelman. It wasn't so clear. Okay, let's pick up right where we left off. Those who recall or recently heard it, the last thing I said, I have it here, is that I was talking about Rabbi Yochanan Wasserman's, kanaut, extremism. That's going to be a theme we're going to see. That he really diverges in great measure from the traditional Lithuanian perspective. And I gave an example of that, that he refused to contribute an essay in the Sefer Yovel, the Jubilee volume for Rabbi Shimon Shkup, the great Rabbi Shimon Shkup, even though Rabbi Shimon Shkup was his teacher. Why did he do that? Because Jubilee volumes are not a traditional thing. We don't generally traditionally recognize people's birthdays like that, and we don't publish volumes in their honor. And I ended, the last thing I note that I did was that I quoted Rav Chaim Ozer, how he also notes that a Sefer Yovel, a Jubilee volume, is not traditional, but he explains why they did it anyway. Before I begin, just to let you know that subsequently I found there's a whole article about Jubilee volumes and birthdays in Jewish tradition. And this is actually, here's the volume. It's a collected volume of articles by Tuvia Preschel, who passed away almost 2 years ago. He was a writer, a bibliographer, originally from Europe and then from Israel, from Vienna, and then from, I think it's from Vienna, and then he lived in Israel, and then he came to America. He actually was taught at, he worked at the seminary. I forget the job he did, something with the library, maybe taught a little, but a big bibliographer and a scholar. He begins by saying, showing that Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector refused to have a Jubilee volume. Rav Shmuel Moliver also didn't want it, but he agreed. And then if you get to East, to Western Europe, it was no longer an issue. And he mentions the first of the West European rabbis is Rav Israel Hildesheimer, who had a Jubilee volume. And there are many others after that. Then, well, okay, so let's begin with a new topic. Among the matters that Rabbi Yochanan dealt with, and we're going to get into all sorts of controversial issues, I think even today, matters which I know are going to trouble people. We spoke about some of them when we dealt with Reuven Katz and Rav Chaim Ozer, but we'll get to them again. One thing we need to remember about Rabbi Yochanan Wasserman is that in his lifetime, he was quite controversial. He did not reflect the traditional Lithuanian perspective. And many people feuded with him. And there were all sorts of controversies. Having said that, he is a Kadosh, of course. He was killed in the Holocaust. And it's true that today his writings are reprinted by the Satmar, and his writings are not really his writings on Hashkafa, on ideology are not reflective of any mainstream position today. Rafsi Yehuda Cook didn't even allow them into the base medrash, into the library, that is, of Merkas Harav, and the Lithuanian Torah world never followed Rabbi Chonon's path. Yet we have to give him the utmost respect as a martyr and as a great Talmud Chacham, but we will, of course, note points of his that we disagree with. And I'm going to call attention to some matters that in the hagiographies they won't even mention, because they know how it's going, how it'll look today, but that's not really intellectually honest, and we'll see this in a few minutes. Rabbi Chanan was one of the people who was asked by a young rabbi named Simon Schwab, who was serving as a rabbi in a small town outside of Frankfurt. That reminds me, those who want to travel with us, Torah in Motion, for the first time, will be going to Germany this summer, in addition to the other trips. I'll be leading the Germany trip, so I'm looking at the names right now. Some of you have been with me to Italy and Central Europe. One has been with me to all the places I've been. And you're cordially welcome to come with us, where we'll talk all about Frankfurt and Torim Derech Eretz. But Rav Shimon Schwab is a very interesting story. Maybe some listening now or listening later on tape knew him personally. I didn't know him, although I did interview him. I can't say that I knew him. But as a young rabbi, he traveled to the East. Today, we go to Eretz Yisrael. We send our young people to go to Israel to learn. And often they come back and their views are not the same as when they left, and they're more religious than their parents. It's a common phenomenon. The same phenomenon took place in the 20s and 30s. But instead of going to the land of Israel, where did they go? German students left Germany and went to the yeshivas in Eastern Europe. They went to Panevej, to Telz, to Sabotka, to Mir. And Rav Shimon Schwab was one of those. And he came back to Germany, and he served as a rabbi there. He was very different. He had an East European yeshiva world perspective. And he even wrote a book explaining why Hirsch's philosophy is not suitable, and it was only meant as an emergency measure. Later in the 60s, he retracted everything he wrote. He said that he wrote that because he didn't understand Hirsch. But he comes back with a yeshiva world mentality and trying to change German orthodoxy. And one of the things he does, it's incredible when you think about it, he writes a letter to a number of East European Jewish sages, the Rugachever, Rabbi Chanan, a bunch of others, the Ger Rebbe, asking, is Torim Derech Eretz a valid lifestyle? Here's a young rabbi who spent all this time in Eastern Europe. He comes back to Germany, and he doesn't appreciate Torim Derech Eretz, the idea that you're going to study secular pursuits. The idea that he would even think, I mean, it's like a lack of respect, a real chutzpah for a young rabbi to write letters to East European rabbis asking them to overturn the entire German Orthodox system, which was established by great Torah sages. And the Ger Rebbe, by the way, recognized this. The Ger Rebbe refused to reply and said that, you know, his attitude was that that you can't say anything to criticize Shimshon Raphael Hirsch's method. You know, now I'm thinking, I have to look in my book. I can't remember if the Ger Rebbe said this in response to Rav Shimon Schwab or in response to someone else. But I think it was Rav Shimon Schwab who asked him. But the others did reply, and they were not fans of Torim Derech Eretz. As I said, later on, Rav Shimon Schwab himself regretted how he acted, and he saw himself as being very juvenile in attempting to overthrow what was put in place by the great German rabbis. But in any event, he does write to them, and one of the people he writes to is Rabbi Chanan Wasserman. The problem with the East European rabbis is many of them didn't understand what Torim Derech was all about. For example, Rabbi Baruch Ber Leibovitz, he writes in his reply that Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch could never have meant it as a lechachila, as that really you should involve yourself in the Western world. It must be, he thought, that they had no choice because they're living in Germany. Of course, he never read Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. So what did Rabbi Chanan reply? And all these letters have been published. Rabbi Chanan made it very clear that he was entirely opposed to the Hirschian method. For him, and there's nothing unexpected in this. We all know that the yeshiva world opposed the German method. And that was the whole point, that all these young students, when they went to study in the yeshivas in the East, when they came back to Germany, they no longer wanted anything to do with Torim Derech Eretz. Those who are interested can see chapter 4 of my book on Rabbi Weinberg. And I'm going to make a note here to check on the Ger Rebbe. Um, I give all the bibliography about this, and I'm still going to publish more material relevant to this, because the Lubavitcher Rebbe was also one of the people who came out against the German Orthodox approach. He wasn't asked by Rabbi Schwab, however. For Rabbi Ochanan, he explains that secular studies are only in order to make a living. And the concept that a yeshiva student would be supported all day for the rest of his life, that did not exist in Eastern Europe. And therefore, all the Rabbanim who reply, they all say that secular studies are valuable, but only in a utilitarian sense, only to make a living. And he says that the Jews of Germany have made a great error in how they regarded secular studies, in that they thought that they were valuable in and of themselves, inherently, which is the Tarim Derech Eretz approach. Instead, Rabbi Hanan says, they're only valuable in order to make a living. And he says that just like with Torah, we say that one should study Lishma, that is, you study Torah for its own sake, not to make a living, not to get a degree, no other purpose other than Lishma. You can study for other purposes, but that's not why you're supposed to. Rav Avadia Yosef has a question in Yechaveh Da'as, his response of Yechaveh Da'at, can one study Torah in order to get a degree? Like, I studied a lot of Torah and I got a PhD for it. I think that's great. I was able to study Torah and get a PhD, but are you allowed to do such a thing? And Rav Avadia Yosef says, yes, you are allowed to do it, but it's not the best thing. The best thing, of course, is to study it Lishma, and not to make a kardom lachbor ba, not to use it to better yourself economically or anything else. Rabbi Hanan says, just like we study Torah lishma for its own sake, so too secular studies have to be shelo lishma, not for their own sake. Now, this doesn't mean that you can't, for example, for enjoyment or relax after a long day of learning, you can't sit down and, read a secular book. But again, that's not lishma. That's just for some enjoyment, to take your mind, to easy stuff. However, to study it for its own sake, because you see inherent value of it. Think of Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch's essays on the spiritual bounty that we get from reading certain German authors. Or think of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, about how valuable to him English literature was. For Rabbi Hanan Wasserman, that's a complete distortion of the traditional approach. That is, these things are only valuable shelo lishma, not for their own sake. Then he says, and this I find really interesting, that why is there so much anti-Semitism in our generation? And in particular, I think he's referring to Germany, because Jews are trying to stand out instead of being inconspicuous. And part of the way they're trying to stand out is by going to the university, by being well-known as academics, all the things that you do when you have advanced secular degrees, instead of being inconspicuous. When the Jews, all they did, you had rabbis, the only intellectuals were rabbis. Everyone else, you had tailors, you had merchants, but no one was involved. I mean, in Germany, you had the people like Rafenau, you had non-Jews involved in government and all sorts of things. He says that is what's bringing about all this anti-Semitism, that Jews are, they're no longer in their place, as it were. They're trying to enter into the non-Jewish area, non-Jewish place. He says that instead of requiring future rabbis to attend a university, in Germany, there was never a requirement. And even the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary, where most rabbis were rabbiner doctors, they came out of it as rabbis with also doctorates. There never was a requirement. That is, you could graduate from the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary, or you could graduate from, you can get smicha in Frankfurt and not be a doctor. But the fact is that there was an expectation that the German Orthodox rabbis would be doctors. And how could there be otherwise if the Reform rabbis were rabbiner doctors? If the Reform rabbis received a doctorate, it was important that the Orthodox rabbis show that they were not any less than the Reform rabbis. That's what led to this idea. Hirsch was not a doctor, but his followers became rabbiner doctors. The difference was, as we've spoken in previous classes, in Frankfurt, when they got a doctorate, it was things like English literature or general philosophy. In Berlin, it was on an aspect of academic Jewish studies. Having said all of this, even though this idea of becoming a rabbiner doctor began in order really to counter what the Reform were doing, and the fact that the people, the masses, expected their rabbis to have a doctorate, just like they expected their rabbis to wear a rabbinical gown and give sermons. I mean, who ever heard of a sermon in Eastern Europe? But I mean, it was expected in Germany in the 19th century that the rabbi would get up and give a sermon, just like we expect, at least in our shuls, the modern shuls, we expect the rabbi to get up and give a sermon. This was never done before the German Orthodox rabbis started doing it. However, once they started going to the university and becoming a rabbin or doctor, it later became a lishma thing as well. It wasn't just secular studies lishma. They thought it was valuable in and of itself to have a doctorate. And that is part of the distortion of tradition that Rabbi Hanan sees. And unlike the Gera Rebbe, who doesn't want to criticize German Orthodoxy in any way, because although it might not be good for us in Eastern Europe, in Germany it is good, Rabbi Hanan is saying that even for you Jews in Germany, this is the wrong approach. Moshe points out that the reason for the affinity to secular studies is because they wanted to stop the hatred of the Gentiles by being like them. And he points out it's just the opposite. When you try to be like them, he's not the first. The Chasam Sofer says something very similar. You try to be like them, and that's even worse. And that makes them hate you even more. In the past semesters, we've quoted others who thought very similarly. And I don't think this is completely inaccurate. For some anti-Semites, they hate all Jews. Other anti-Semites, it was precisely the fact that Jews were now assuming a place. They were trying to enter a position of authority in Germany in areas of economics, in all sorts of areas. And for certain people, they could tolerate Jews when the Jews were by themselves, but they couldn't tolerate Jews actually taking over German culture. And if you know about German culture, in all areas of German culture, in philosophy, in science, in literature, Jews were first and foremost, as we always are. Once they give us an opportunity, we usually rise to the top. And all you have to do is look at all the Nobel Prize winners. And there's no question that that led certain people to become anti-Semitic. I guess the response to Rabbi Hanan would be, so what? So if they're going to be anti-Semitic, you know, that's not a reason for us not to achieve what we're able to achieve. But there is some truth that that led to some anti-Semitism. Rabbi Hanan also makes it a very interesting comment. He has all these essays. I just culled some of the important aspects, I think, or some of the interesting. You could spend 20 weeks dealing with Rabbi Hanan. The best collection today is this volume, Kovetz Ma'amarim V'Igrot, which has his letters and his articles. I'll be citing page numbers for this. One of the things he says is that your faith in Torah should be even greater than what you see with your own eyes. That's he has an article, Magderot Be'emunah. That's an interesting perspective, that your faith should be stronger than what you see with your own eyes. On the one hand, it's very powerful, because if you see something that appears to go against Torah, you immediately reject it, because your belief in Torah is not based upon what you see with your own eyes. That also is interesting, because it shows you that our belief in Torah is not based on evidence, really. I see this as sort of a rejection of the old Kuzari approach. Evidence of the sort, these rational proofs for Torah, are not what guide us. Our belief in it and our faith, our connection, is much stronger. His teacher, Rabbi Chaim, said that the definition of emuna, of faith, is where evidence stops. That is, if you can prove it, it's not faith. You know, if you tell me that it's like 2 plus 2 equals 4, that's not faith. Emuna begins where evidence stops. This is, the Rav Shach uses this, I mentioned in the past, to actually explain something in the Rambam, and it's actually the exact opposite of what the Rambam says. If you look in the Sefer HaMitzvot, the Book of Commandments, the first mitzvah in the standard translation is to belief in God. And Rav Shach uses this idea of Rav Chaim to explain the Rambam's formulation of belief. But as I've mentioned in the past, the real translation is not belief there. The real translation, it's this Arabic word itikad, and the translation of it really means to know, and therefore it's exactly parallel to the beginning of the Mishnah Torah, where the Rambam says, Yisod Yesodot V'Amud HaChachmot, the essence of the Yesod, the great principle, is not to believe that there is a God, but Leida, to know. And what does it mean to know? That's in all the different proofs and everything. But that's what Reb Chaim says, and Reb Chanan says similarly that our faith is stronger than anything we see. I mean, that's normally what people assume. You're seeing is believing, and no, you can see a magician do tricks from the Egyptian magicians. You can see all sorts of things. Our faith has to be stronger than anything that someone could, quote, prove to us, because our faith triumphs over these proofs, which are really false proofs, but from our perspective, they might look like proofs, but don't be led astray by that. But as I said, this is a double-edged sword, because not only does this go against so-called scientific proofs against Torah, this very argument can be used to reject the so-called Torah proofs. I don't know how many people really believe these sorts of things. But I mean, in one part of the Kirov world, you have this whole idea that you can prove Emunah completely, and anyone who doesn't accept it shows that they're not being honest. I mean, I know a lot of honest people. I work with a lot of not honest non-Jews, and you know, that's not why they don't not accept it, because they're not honest. Now, having said all this, I think Reb Chanan might contradict himself later on, as we'll see. Because he does later say something which appears to argue that if you get away of all your negiot and just look at things clearly, the evidence of God's existence in Torah should be clear. But we'll get back to that, and we can talk about whether it's a contradiction. Reb Chanan differed from a number of Rosh Yeshiva. In Eastern Europe, many of the Rosh Yeshiva did not involve themselves in politics. They had viewpoints, no question about it. And most of them... not just most, the overwhelming majority, tilted in the direction of Agudas Yisrael. Not all of them, but most of them did, and some of them would have been completely, you know, very clear believers in it. However, many of them, I don't know if it's most, but many of them refused to identify publicly with the organization, the reason being that they had to raise money from all different camps, Zionists, non-Zionists, and therefore they had to be above politics. Reb Chanan was not like that. Reb Chanan openly identified with Agudas Yisrael, and as we'll see, he was on the right wing of Agudas Yisrael. And why did he identify? Why isn't it Bittul Torah? What led him to be involved with this organization? He said the reason was because the Chafetz Chaim, and he respected no one more than the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim thought it was important. If the Chafetz Chaim thought it wasn't important, either because the ideology wasn't in his, he didn't accept the ideology, or because it was a waste of time for him, leave it for other people to do it, he wouldn't have. But the Chafetz Chaim thought it was important. Now, mind you, the other great influence on Reb Chanan, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, he was not a member of Agudas Yisrael. He at first he was involved with it, and it wasn't going in his direction the way he appreciated. He left Agudas Yisrael. And here we see, however, that although Reb Chanan had great respect and admiration for Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, when it came to a choice between Reb Chaim Soloveitchik and the Chafetz Chaim, he went with the Chafetz Chaim's opinion. Reb Chanan was one of the early advocates of the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah. Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah is the Council of Torah Sages. And the Council of Torah Sages actually functioned. There was a time, it doesn't function anymore. It exists, but it doesn't really function. And I'll explain what I mean by that. But originally, the idea was you'd have a whole council of Torah Sages. And to say Torah Sages is not so clear either. And because you had Lithuanian Torah Sages and various Hasidic leaders who had large followings, some of whom were great Torah Sages, like the Gerer Rebbe. But others were not, you know, would not have been regarded by the Lithuanians as great Torah sages, but this was an organization trying to join the Torah world. So it had the Hasidic world of Poland, not of Hungary, because the Hungarians didn't accept it. It had the Lithuanian Torah world, and it had the German Orthodox world, and those people like German Orthodox Jews wherever they were. And the idea was that these leading figures would be on a council, and the council would meet and decide issues, and then they'd debate it behind closed doors, and then they would come out with a position that would establish, you know, what the Agudas Yisrael position was. It would be the Das Torah. And those rabbis who disagreed with the final decision, their job was to go along with it. At least in theory, their job was to go along with it. And it worked basically well in the early decades. Later on, it pretty much fell apart for the simple reason that Agudas Yisrael, the people in Agudas Yisrael, left the Moetzes idea, the council idea, and went towards what I call a papal model. And the Pope has, and the Vatican has it also. You have councils, like they have the Second Vatican Council, and you also have the papal model. What is the papal model? A term I invented, I think, for this. It's the idea being that you don't go to a council, you go to one sage. So there's an entire book called Mikatavitz ad Hebe'er by his name is escaping me. It's a very good book. He passed away last year, by a Haredi historian who shows how the Moetzes Gedolei Torah basically became a rubber stamp, and had in the last 50 years really hasn't done anything. Because what happened is you went to great sages. So, for example, the Chazon Ish. If the Chazon Ish says this is what you should do, what is the Moetzes HaGedolei going to do? And then you have the Stipur, and you have Rav Shach, and you had Rav Yashav. And there was a split, of course, in Agudas Yisrael. But then you went, you had Degel HaTorah for the Lithuanians. In other words, it seems that the Lithuanian world now is led by figures, you know, a unique Torah sage. So every time a great Torah sage, a leader, passes away, then they appoint another one. When Rav Yashav passed away, Rav Chaim Kanievsky came out with a statement that the mantle of leadership has now been passed to Rav Steinman. I mean, where does this idea come from? The mantle of leadership has now been passed. Why is it passed like that? Who determines such a thing? But that's the model that now exists. And you didn't have this model in previous years. You never had language like that in the 19th century about the model of leadership has now been passed. And you know that after 120, when Steinman passes away, the mantle will be passed to another Lithuanian sage. Oh, thank you, David. Steve Weinman. They created a situation where the mantle of leadership gets passed. There isn't a council of cardinals or anything like that. It's simply the leadership, the Askanim and the Rosh Yeshiva. And it's not always, although it was pretty much unanimous in previous years, the last time it wasn't unanimous. And if you follow the Lithuanian world, you know there was a dispute whom the mantle should be passed to. Most of them said it should go to Rabbi Steinman, and others said it goes to Rav Shmuel Auerbach. But Rabbi Ochanan was one of the advocates of a Moetzes Gedolei Torah, and he was actually very open-minded in this, because he said that even a Torah sage who's not a member of Agudas Yisrael should be appointed to the Moetzes Gedolei Torah. He's not speaking about Mizrahi types, but figures such as Rav Chaim Soloveitchik or Hungarian rabbis, even if they were not members of Agudas Yisrael, he thought that their opinions were still valuable and they should be on the Moetzes Gedolei Torah, you know, even if they oppose it, some of the Agudas ideas, or maybe they're not in Aguda because they don't believe in political involvement. And this model of Rabbi Ochanan actually continued. The Chazon Ish was never a member of Agudas Yisrael, and yet all the members of the Moetzes and the deputies for Agudas Yisrael, they always went to the Chazon Ish, asked him his opinion. The Brisker Rav was never a member of Agudas Yisrael, and yet the members of Agudas Yisrael always went to get his opinion. So that's what Rabbi Ochanan was speaking about. Not that they joined the Moetzes Gedolei Torah as he would have liked it, but they went to ask questions. Rabbi Ochanan, well, let me go back for a second. Agudas Yisrael, the rabbis in Agudas Yisrael had a variety of views on all matters. Let's talk about secular studies, for instance. There was always a place on the dais for German Orthodoxy. German Orthodoxy founded the Agudas Yisrael. The German Orthodox rabbis were always respected. This stopped in the 60s when there was no longer a place for them. And Mordechai Breuer, the great-grandson of Hirsch, wrote an open letter explaining that, you know, until now, all the Agudas Yisrael conventions always had room for us, a different approach, and no longer. And of course, it doesn't exist anymore. But there was room for the German Orthodox, there were room for the Hasidim, and there was room for all different views about matters such as Zionism, about settling the land of Israel. When I say Zionism, let me take that back. I don't mean political Zionism, because no one involved in the Agudas Yisrael was what we would call a political Zionist, or they would have been a Mizrahiite. However, there was all sorts of different views how much to cooperate with the Zionists. Is a state a positive thing, or a Jewish state a positive thing, or a negative thing? Should we encourage Aliyah? Over all these questions, Rabbi Ochanan Wasserman was on the right wing of the Aguda. as far on the right as you can go. Later on, next class, I don't think it'll be this class, we'll speak about the great debate in Marienbad. I don't think, I can't remember if we spoke about it last semester. Maybe we spoke, we'll speak about it this semester. The great 1937 conference when the Aguda had to decide, are they going to support the establishment of the State of Israel? And you'll see what Rabbi Chanan's position was, and it was a minority position. But he was on the right. He was, I guess you could say, a complete rejectionist when it came to Zionism. And not just Zionism, but those whom he thought had compromised with Zionism. Very soon we'll see great machlokas between, not just between him and Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, but between him and the Chazon Ish even. So Rabbi Chanan Wasserman was really as far on the right as you could go and still be in Aguda. So, for example, when Rabbi Chanan heard reports, certainly false reports, but reports reached him in Europe that there were discussions between the Eda Charidit, led by Rav Dushinsky, and the chief rabbinate about merging the Batei Din of the two, he writes to Rav Dushinsky telling him that that would be Achil Hashem, to merge the Beis Din of the Eda Charidit with the chief rabbinate. I can't imagine any such conversations ever happened. This had to have been false information. The only, I won't even say there was never talk of making one shlita, making one based in. The only time there was cooperation even was during the 1948 war, when you had cooperation between Rav Dushinsky and Rav Herzog, who personally, by the way, got along. But there never could have been a joint based in or anything like that. Now, the biographies. There are two biographies on Rabbi Chanan. There's a very long one, a two-volume biography by Aaron Sorosky that appears in Hebrew called Or El Chanan. And I use that, of course. And then there's the Art Scroll biography. Here it is, Rabbi Chanan. Now, this says on the title page, adapted from Aaron Sorosky's Hebrew biography. So this is, it's smaller than the two-volume work, and it leaves out all the footnotes, or almost all the footnotes. But it's the text is pretty much the same. What the biographies, all they do is mention that Rabbi Chanan wrote to Rav Dushinsky not to, you know, join with the chief rabbinate. They don't mention the extent of what he says in his letter. Let me tell you what Rabbi Chanan actually says to Rav Dushinsky. And this is in... You can find this in this book. It's called and many other places this letters are printed. Yalkut Ma'amarim Umichtavim, published by the Satmar on page 152. But as I said, you can find this letter reprinted in a number of places. He writes to him, he says, I don't know you. How would Rabbi Chanan know Rav Dushinsky? Rav Dushinsky is Hungarian. What is Rabbi Chanan? He knows all the literature. He says, I don't know you. But I'm writing to you, and he knows that it's not my place to make suggestions to you, but sometimes you have to make suggestions, he says, and he says this has to do with Achil Shem Shamayim in a terrible way. So that's why he's writing. He says that he heard that there's talk of merging the Beis Din of the Eda Charidit to the chief rabbinate, and then he says, it's known that the one who stands at the head of the Beis Din of the chief rabbinate, what does he do? He signs kol korings, that is letters, open letters, to encourage Jews to donate money to the Keren HaYesod. I'll explain what the Keren HaYesod is in a minute. And it's known also that the money from the Keren HaYesod goes l'gadel kofri mohachis. It goes to raise up... heretics, not heretics who don't know any better, who aren't, you know, real heretics, people who want to destroy Judaism. And that's true. I mean, the early kibbutz, it's not like today where the people don't know anything. These early kibbutzim, people came from yeshiva backgrounds and good Jewish educations, and they joined atheist kibbutzim with the assistance of the Keren HaYesod. And then he says, therefore, one who supports this, namely Rav Kook, is causing others to sin in the most grievous way. And then he says, if we see someone who praises the wicked people, that is Rav Kook. Yodim anu shezehu Rasha gamur. We know that he is completely wicked. He's saying that Rav Kook is completely wicked. Ba'ofen shehadavar baror she'asur lishaber l'isha kazeh. Therefore, Rav Kook lends his support and praises the Keren Hayasod. And anyone who would do this is wicked, because they do terrible things, the Keren Hayasod, from the Jewish standpoint. Therefore, it's forbidden to join with this wicked person. And he says, if I was worthy, I would say that anyone who thinks that this is a good idea to join the two Beistins, it's worthy of being put in Chayrim. And then he goes on, not only is there an Isser of Hischabrus LaRasha, we're forbidden to join with a wicked one, namely Rav Kook. It's also going to be a Chil Hashem. And he says, I don't think that you would ever agree to this, Rabbi Dushinsky, but maybe there are people around you who don't know anything about real Torah values. Okay, Yud Mem. If this is Yud Mem, the Yud Mem I'm thinking of from Lakewood, we're dealing with a really top scholar here. But yes, I was going to speak about Harav Eitam Henkin. It's the people like you who sometimes anticipate what I'm going to say, so I'm flattered. Yes, I'll speak about... let me just tell you guys before I get to explain what the Keren Hayasod is, because that's what Yudem is referring to. Rav Chana Wasserman was fed false information. Rav Kook never supported the Keren Hayasod. But I'll get to that, and I'll speak about Eitam Henkin in a few minutes. I know Dov Weinstein asked me to speak about him, and I will speak about him. Unfortunately, all the information I'm going to talk about now can be seen in a beautiful article by Eitam Henkin. Even before Eitam Henkin wrote the article, there was knowledge of what I'm going to say and what Eitam Henkin wrote about, but he really documented it. Before I go on, let me just say a word about Eitam Henkin. Eitam Henkin, who was murdered 30 days ago, I was going to write something. I have a new Sforim blog post. One just went up today. It actually went up a couple days ago, but for some reason the announcement didn't go out, so they had to repost it. But I have another one that's going to go out up in another week. And I was going to write all about Eitam Henkin and my relationship with him. I'm not going to, I think, only because my relationship with him was really just, it wasn't a personal, it was just through emails, many, many emails over years. But people who knew him well and have already written, so... But what I'll say here for everyone is that this man, Eitam Henkin, obviously it's an incredible personal tragedy for the family and everyone else, but it's a scholarly tragedy of the sort that, it's really hard to comprehend. The guy was 31 years old. He had already published more articles. Two books he published, including one dealing with Rav Kook and, the Vat HaLumi. And another halachic work, a work he wrote, by the way, when he was in his early 20s, was published, I think he was 24 or 25 years old. And now a book just came out, the new one on Hilchos Shabbos. At 31 years old, he had published more articles than most tenured professors ever write. And let me tell you something about these articles. I won't write this on a blog because I think people might think, I don't know, maybe they'll think I'm violating Lo Sachmot or something like that. I don't know, but I'll say it. Years ago, I remember hearing an interview with Billy Joel, and the interviewer, this goes back at least 20 years, the interviewer asked him, do you ever hear a song and wish you wrote it? And I still remember to this day what Billy Joel said, and every time I hear the song in the car, I think of this interview. He said, I wish I would have written Neil Young, Hey Hey My My, Rock and Roll Will Never Die. And I thought that was, that's giving a compliment when you say, when he's saying that, that's so great, I wish I did it. Anyone who writes articles knows that sometimes you see articles and you say, boy, would I have liked to have written that article, because it's so powerful and you think it's so wonderful. And there are really two people today who again and again I see their articles and I say that. And both of them are younger than me. Both of them are, in a sense, my teacher. I mean, I've learned so much from both of them. One is Yechiel Goldhaber, who's older than Eitam. I mean, he writes so many articles. I see his articles and I'm like, wow. By the way, if the YM I'm looking at is the one I'm thinking it is, in the latest issue of a certain journal, there's a year volume, there's an article I wish I would have written about a mikveh in Italy. But be that as it may, I think that's the biggest compliment. And I say that about Eitan Henkin. Every time I'd read one of his articles, I'd say, wow, had I had that idea, if I could have written that article, because he was so creative and so wonderful in his scholarship. It's, I mean, I don't know what else to say. It's just a, it's an unbelievable loss when you think of what he could have accomplished and what we're missing. So I'll leave it at that about Eitan Henkin. They had the Shloshim yesterday, and I, by the way, I'm not like the Art Scroll, because Art Scroll, as I said, they don't mention this, and Sarosky doesn't mention what Rabbi Chanan says about Rav Kook. They just leave it out. Now, why don't they mention it? And first of all, Art Scroll never says anything negative about Rav Kook. So that's one of the reasons, but other people who are not such fans about Rav Kook also wouldn't cite this of Rabbi Chanan, because they think it would reflect negatively about on Rabbi Chanan in people's eyes. They'd say, oh, look what he said. By the same token, you don't find people like Avi Shafran on the rest. You know, they'll quote Rabbi Steinman when they want to, but if he says something that would be shocking, let's say, to Americans or even to Haredim, they won't quote it. They become the gatekeepers, the censors. I spoke in the past about what the Hebrew book says about Rav Yashav. So involved in Torah, he didn't even know his grandchildren's name, and that appears in Hebrew, but in English translation, they leave it out. So yeah, my approach, of course, is, you know, we have to understand everything, and we can't censor it. We have to see what is said, and therefore you cite Rav Chanan. Turns out that he was fed false information, and that's what led him to say what he said. So I just say this because I've received a number of emails from people. At the Shloshim, and I think Dov Weinstein would appreciate this, at the Shloshim 2 nights ago, Rav Meir Mazuz spoke. Now, those who follow my Sforim blog post, you've heard it here. I think that Rav Meir Mazuz is the greatest Torah scholar we have today. And I can explain another time why I think so, just in his all-encompassing knowledge in so many ways. And unbelievable. He wrote a haskama, an approbation for Eitan Henkin's Sefer. He has an approbation, apparently, for the new one. There must be some relationship with the father, because the letter he wrote to Yehuda Herzl Henkin, he calls him Yedidenu. And so he came to the speak at the Shloshim. And you hear he's speaking. You got to give him all the credit. You know, it's not easy for him to travel. He's not that well. And he's speaking for a group of women also. And it would have been a great evening. And unfortunately, you know, they just think differently than us. He threw in this, the gay pride parade. And, you know, even a man as great as him, who said so many great stuff, I'm going to write a post about him, how in the election he held himself. He didn't go into the gutter when Sholem Cohen was saying things. You know, Sholem Cohen said that Kisei Rachamim Yeshiva, his yeshiva, it's the Beit HaKisei. That he said such terrible things. He always, you know, he said the right things. He never went, you know, didn't. I mean, I have to say, and I'm not going to cover it up. It was a terrible thing that he said, that even great rabbis sometimes say things that are just incomprehensible for us. In a different world that he's in, he could say it, but I can't fathom how such a man at a funeral would think it's appropriate to start speaking about the gay pride parade. And, you know, that's what causes all of our problems. But I'm not going to cover it up. I mentioned this because someone emailed me. He's saying, oh, so he's your great gadol. Look at this. So, like, I'd cover it up. Like, I wouldn't talk about it. No, of course I'll talk about it. I mean, he's not my Das Torah where I can't ever disagree with something he says. He's still the great Torah scholar, I think. But he said something which is unfortunate. And everyone, public speakers in my mind, always get a few passes. Because if you're speaking every day, and Rav Mazuz is giving shiur every single day, you can watch it online. If you're speaking, just like politicians, you're speaking, you know, 15 hours a day, you got to give people a few passes to say a few inappropriate things. It's when it becomes more and more, but of course it bothers me and it troubles me, and I wish you didn't say it. Now, let me go back. I'll get to the questions in 5 minutes. I'll stop and I'll look at all your questions. So let me explain now what went down with Rav Chanan Wasserman here, and what's the Keren HaYesod? And what did Rav Kook support? Rav Kook, and those who want further details, go to Eitan Henkin's article. You can go to the blog, and not the blog, they call it a blog, but it has all his articles, so eitanhenkin.wordpress.com or something like that. You can read the article. What Rav Kook encouraged financial support for was the Keren HaKayemet, the Keren Kayemet, not the Keren HaYesod. So what's the difference? Now, Rav Chanan is attacking Rav Kook for supporting the Keren HaYesod. Rav Kook never supported the Keren HaYesod. I certainly hope that someone told Rav Chaim about this. The Keren Kayemet goes back to the 19th century, and it had one purpose and one purpose only, to the JNF, to acquire land in the land of Israel. That's it. And Rav Kook supported that because they were acquiring land from the absentee landlords, from the Turks and Arabs, etc. And that's what was needed, land in Eretz Yisrael. And that's all they're doing. So who cares if the person who runs the Keren Kayemet is religious or not? They're providing land, land upon which you can set up religious settlements. The Keren HaYesod is something different. Keren HaYesod was established in 1920. That was the financial arm of the World Zionist Organization. And it did some good things. For example, it financed Aliyah and enabled many Jews to settle in Eretz Israel. But it also did other things. It financed non-religious schools. It helped settlers who were, you know, settled people who weren't Shomer Shabbos. Rav Kook said explicitly he cannot support the Keren HaYesod because it has no religious component. Not only does it have no religious component, it's worse than that. It enables irreligiosity. It funds irreligious events. And Rav Kook was opposed to, and he never asked for support for the Keren HaYesod, but he did ask support for Keren Kayemet. On the other hand, there were rabbis who did support Keren HaYesod. Rav Meir Simcha of Divinsk supported Keren HaYesod. I don't know if Rav Chanan knew this. He came out with an open statement in favor of Keren HaYesod. Rav Meir Simcha supported Keren HaYesod? Well, I mean, you can say, same way we support certain organizations which have good and have bad. They also had a lot of good thing. They helped bring tens of thousands of Jews to Eretz Yisrael. So you can say that I'm supporting, I don't know what he said, because I don't know if he was ever asked the question to explain, you know, what about the irreligiosity. Maybe Rav Meir Simcha didn't know about the irreligious elements when he signed this proclamation. Or maybe he knew about it, but he's saying, well, the money I'm giving is going to support the settlement of the Jews in the land of Israel. I mean, I don't know, but it's a fact that he did support it. That reminds me of a famous story when the Eda Haridit came to raise money for some of their institutions in America. They went to Boston. And this story was told by the president of Maimonides School. What's his name? He was coming out of the, they went to get money from him, and he refused to give them. He'd give money to the Eda Haridit with their craziness. Lo and behold, later in the day, he goes to see Rabbi Soloveitchik, and who's coming out? The Eda Haridit Meshulach, and he shows what's the name? Any Bostonians, write the name of the big Maimonides Macher. He shows him the check, and, you know, you didn't give me. Look what Rabbi Soloveitchik gave me. So he went in there, and he said to the Rav, you know, how could you give him any money? You know that if you ever go to Israel, they'll be the first ones there at the airport protesting you and telling you go back to America. And the Rav smiled and says, yes, but he promised me that the tzedakah I give him is not going to be used to buy signs. So I don't know. Maybe Rav Henkin had this conception that the money I'm giving is being used to settle Jews there and other, because it wasn't a good organization. I don't know. But that's a fact about the Meir Simcha. Rabbi Chanan also stood at the forefront, together with the Chafetz Chaim, in opposing plans by the Polish government to require Polish rabbis to have secular educations and know Polish, and also that teachers in cheder would have a basic competency. There are many Jews, including Orthodox Jews, who thought that, you know, you can't just have this free-for-all with cheders, that, you know, there should be some sort of basic competency as teachers. And there are many Orthodox Jews who also thought that the rabbi should know Polish. So although this was a government decree, just like earlier you had in Russia, many Orthodox Jews thought this was fine. Don't you want a rabbi who can intercede, who can deal with the government and everything? But the Chafetz Chaim and Rabbi Chanan opposed it. Now that in and of itself is not surprising. What is surprising is the next step. Who should intercede with the government? There was all sorts of problems. I mean, there was bans on Shlita, talk about bans on Shlita, which later on were instituted in Poland. But there were all sorts of problems that the Polish Jews had with the government, a lot of anti-Semitic leaders there. Agudas Yisrael was in the parliament. Agudas Yisrael was in the local parliaments. He had other things. So you needed people to intercede. You needed people to intercede at the highest level, with leading church figures and leading political figures. So who should be the person that the Agudas Yisrael sends? It was obvious. Rav Aaron Levin. Rav Aaron Lewin. Levin. Lewin, in, I guess you'd say now in English, who's the grandfather of Nat Lewin, the famous constitutional lawyer. He was a deputy in the Polish parliament. He was the Rav. He was a communal Rav of Risha, and he was a also a great Talmud Chacham. He wrote responsa of the Avnei Chayfetz, and he had perfect Polish. Most of the other rabbis didn't speak Polish, didn't speak Russian. They might have understood some, but they couldn't speak it. He gave long speeches in the parliament. So if you're going to have someone to go meet with the Polish premier, who do you take if not the Reicher Rav or Aaron Lewin? And that's who would be, and the one who makes these wonderful speeches and defends Jewish honor in the parliament. And that's what most Orthodox Jews wanted, and I dare say most rabbis in Poland thought he has to be the one to go, because he could best explain the Orthodox position. Believe it or not, Rav Elchanan Wasserman, and he was joined in this by Rav Aaron Cutler, and we'll see later on, this is not the only time they joined together, and some others, they opposed this choice. They said, we can't send Rav Aaron Lewin to go speak to the president. Why not? Because they said, we are arguing that the rabbi should not be forced to have no secular studies, should not be forced to know Polish. Here, if we're going to send Rav Aaron Lewin there, we're basically acknowledging that it's good to have a rabbi with the ability to speak well in Polish. Undercuts everything we're saying, that all a rabbi needs to know is Torah. Therefore, who do you send to speak? You send a balabas, important communal leaders. They go speak, but not a spiritual leader. Most rabbis in Poland did not accept this at all. Even if they agreed with Rabbi Chanan that a rabbi doesn't need to know Polish, all he needs to know is Torah, and anytime you have dealings with the government, you don't need to have the communal rabbi, you have other people do it. They still believe that since we happen to have a rabbi who happened to learn Polish on his own, he never went to school, and he speaks it fluently, let's take advantage of it. But no, Rabbi Chanan thought that the message it sent was a wrong message. That is, the message it sent was that it's a positive thing that our rabbi should all be like Rav Aaron Lewin. He had nothing against Rav Aaron Lewin. It was just that this should not be the model that we have. Now, in parliament, of course he speaks, but he's not there as a rabbi. He was elected to parliament. He's a parliamentarian. He happens to be a rabbi. But here we don't want to send him as a rabbi to speak in Polish. This is a position that then many people didn't accept. And today, of course, no one would accept such a position. I think if you went to the most right-wing Aguda circles, I'm not talking Satmar here or New Square, and you said to them, is it important for our rabbi to know English? They'd say, obviously, it's important for a rabbi to know English. I heard from The chief rabbi of Warsaw, Shlomo David Kahana. He wasn't the official chief rabbi, by the way, but everyone called him that, who then goes to the land of Israel after the war. Right before. And he becomes chief rabbi of the old city. His son was, what's his name, Shmuel Zanvil Kahana, the Shazak, who's the father-in-law of Gabi Cohen from Michala, from Machon Gold. I had dinner once with Shmuel Zanvil Kahana, and I heard all sort of, he was head of he was the director, I don't know what you call it, the man who ran it, the officer in charge, not the minister of religions, but the head of the ministry of religions, that is the official in charge, I forget what you call that person. Oh, I heard all sorts of interesting things about how Rav Huttner wanted to be chief rabbi, et cetera, et cetera. But he told me something else, which is fascinating, because he's from Warsaw. He told me that he remembered you'd have these people who'd sit by the courthouses and the government buildings in Warsaw, and their job was to write up documents and translate documents from Polish into Yiddish, because the typical Jew from the shtetl who would come to Warsaw to take care of things didn't know Polish. It's an amazing thing when you think of it. It's like, think of Fiddler on the Roof. When that one guy there who reads the newspaper, among the old-fashioned Orthodox, many people did not speak the language of the land. They didn't speak Polish very well. And of the older generation, many really didn't speak it very well at all. The younger generation of the irreligious, of course, spoke it, and even of the Orthodox, they did. But of the older generation, it's hard to imagine, but that's what he told me. Let me stop here and we'll take some comments and questions. We have a lot to do. We're going to talk about Avoda Ivrit. If you remember, those who were with us last semester, two semesters ago, we dealt with it with Reuven Katz, but we have to return to it. We're going to get into the Marienbad dispute. You know, should Aguda support us, a Jewish state? And many, many more things to come. In this semester, we're doing Rabbi Yochanan Wasserman. I don't know how many classes on him. This is our third class. I guess probably do about six classes on him, so maybe three more. And then we'll start, we won't finish, Rav Avadya Yosef, the middle years. And then for a future class, in response to a request, I'm going to do Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer. We have a lot to look forward to. Let me start answering some questions. And thank you all for signing up this semester. Let me go back here. I'm going back. So, David from Baltimore says, I didn't know that Bertrand Russell wrote, I should like to have written it myself. I was worried if I could actually write that because people might say that not that actually I'm violating, you know, one of the Ten Commandments. No one wants to do that. But if you don't say that, then it's not a good trait. But I don't think so. I don't think it's not like someone has a car and if someone else has a car, well, maybe if someone has a car and I say I want his car, that's a violation. If I say I want a car like his car, I don't want to take his car. I don't want to take his wife. I just want a wife like, also a wife, a good wife like his wife. That's not a problem. I don't want to take his article that he wrote it. He wrote it. I'm in awe of it. I look at it. I enjoy it. I just wish that that I would have thought of all these great ideas he did. So that's, but I didn't want to write that because people might have thought that it's inappropriate. Believe me, I don't want to take anything from him. Saying from bronze out the blue Danube. Okay, I get maybe it's a natural feeling. You see something, and I don't know. Moshe from Lakewood says in another letter where he disparages Rav Fishman, he refers to Kronos and Plural that defile the land. Yeah, of course, Rav Fishman's a much different situation, but we'll get into more detail because his great dispute, not just with Reuven Katz we spoke about, he's going to dispute with the Chazon Ish when it comes to the land of Israel and the Vadu'umi. Even the Chazon Ish, who is not known for being a compromiser, like some might say Rav Isser Zalman was, the Chazon Ish rejects what Rav Isser Zalman says. There are no articles by Eitam Henkin available in English, and Eitam Henkin grew up in an English-speaking home. His parents both speak English at home, as did his brother. And you see something there which is, you don't often see. I know a lot of people who grew up in Israel whose parents were English speakers, and basically they speak, their Hebrew has the perfect Hebrew accent that you only get if you grew up there, but their English is pretty much without accents. I know lots and lots of people from American parents who grew up in Israel, and they don't have accents. Did anyone here go online, and you can go to YouTube and plug in Yagil Henkin. You listen to Eitam's brother. I don't know if it's a younger or older brother. And listen to his English. He speaks it fluently, but the accent is so strong. I don't know how you grow up in an English-speaking home and have such an accent. Eitam Henkin was the same way. He grew up in an English-speaking home, but he told me that he did. I asked him to write something for the Sfarim blog, and he said he doesn't feel comfortable writing in English, even though that's his first language. He really was a complete Hebraist in that sense. So unfortunately, he has no articles in English, but someone emailed me a few days ago that there's a project right now to translate by the RCA, I believe. That's what this guy said, by the RCA. I don't know what the Rabbinical Council of America would do with that. They're too busy attacking women rabbis and things like that. But I don't know. But he said that there's a project from the RCA or some rabbis in the RCA to translate the best articles. Again, who's to determine the best? But some of the best articles from Eitam Henkin into English. So we can look forward to that. And they will, I'm certain, take all these articles and publish them together in a collection. He was so gracious. If you look on the website, you see I pointed out a mistake he made. So he puts it on the website that Mark Shapiro, you know, corrected this mistake I made. It's the article about Rav Shapochnik, was it? Shapochnik, the crazy rabbi in London. Another article I wish I could have written. He identified Rav Rav Yechezkel Abramsky's as being on the Beis Din, the Machzikei Hadas, and it wasn't. It was the Beis Din of the London community. And apparently, from what I read, the Sefer, he wrote a whole Sefer on Hilchos Shabbos, and that just came out. If you read the Sfarim blog post by David Asaf in both Hebrew and English, and then read the comments, you'll see very different ways of how to view Eitam Henkin. And then you can read the family comes to the defense of David Asaf. I don't know. I think the family likes David Asaf. They appreciate him. They know he did so much for Eitam Henkin, and therefore they're defending him against all the attacks against him. As I would defend him if I were the family. I mean, David Asaf was so good to Eitam. If it wasn't for David Asaf, Eitam would not have gotten this unbelievable scholarship he had, this fellowship, and he worked with him. But if you ask them privately, there is no way they can agree with what he said. He writes that Eitam Henkin, he says he left the yeshiva world, you know, the religious Zionist yeshiva world, because so he wouldn't have to waste his time, you know, bizbuz, on, you know, halachic matters. That is such a distortion of Eitam Henkin, who he was. He just, you know, finished a book on Hilchos Shabbos. He was going to Yoel Katan. By mistake, he called him doctor once. He thought he was a doctor. He wasn't. And Yoel and Eitam said that, you know, he doesn't want to have any recognition of his secular studies. And the plan was, as his brother revealed, that he was going to be appointed Rosh Yeshiva of a new yeshiva in memory of Rav Shlomo Goren, I think Ateret Shlomo or something like that. So although he was going to get a PhD and although he was going to continue writing his articles, he still was going to continue writing his Sfarim. I can send anyone who wants a PDF, which Eitan himself gave me, of the Sefer on bugs. It has the approbation of Rav Nevensal, who says he agrees with everything in it, and Rav Mazuz. This is a whole book on the, you can buy the book as well, on the halachas of eating bugs, and it's much more lenient than anything that happens today in America with the OU and all these other organizations. But so here is someone who's an unbelievable eloi. If you read the comment on the post, David Asaf's Hebrew, you have by the person who roomed with him. He went to Poland or Ukraine, one of these places, for a conference. It was the first time Eitam Henkin ever spoke publicly about his research, his academic research. And the person who was his roommate, because they put him up with a roommate, wrote in response to David Asaf that David Asaf has it all wrong. Of course Eitam Henkin's an academic scholar and loves the university, but it's not as if he's leaving, you know, the Torah world behind because these matters are not important. He writes about how every minute he'd be learning. When the roommate went out with everyone else at night, they had cultural activities, a concert, this and that, Eitam stayed in his room and was learning all day, Masachas Chulin, and during the lectures, he had a computer in front of him and he was learning. So of course he valued his academic pursuits, but the idea that, it's almost like what they say about the Rambam, you know, when he went to the guy for the perplex, he didn't care anymore about, you know, halachic matters. If he didn't care about halachic matters, he wouldn't have spent all those years writing the Mishnah Torah. No one who is not completely involved in halacha would write a Mishnah Torah. By the same token, Eitam Henkin would not be writing an entire Sefer on Hilchos Shabbos at the same time he's writing academic pursuits, if both these were not the essence of who he was. And that's what made him so great. This Saturday night, for those in the New York area, I will. Let me just finish up the questions and then we'll end. Why would Keren Kayemet be any better? Keren Kayemet, because it has no religious component. All they do is they buy land for people. And then they buy land in Chutz Laaretz. So you could say, well, you know, they buy the land and then irreligious Jews can settle the land. But, you know, for people like Rav Kook, it's better to be an irreligious Jew in the land of Israel than not. All they do is buy land. There's no cultural element. They're not funding irreligious schools. For many of the early Chovei Tzion, the problem was when the Zionist movement began to then get involved in kultura, culture, tarbut. When it was just about getting a state, settling Jews there, you had many of the so-called Haredim who thought this was a good idea. So there's what would be wrong then with Keren Kayemet? It was not a religious organization. It was not an irreligious organization. It's like an organization designed to combat anti-Semitism or to, you know, to give people food. So I will be speaking this Saturday night at 8 p.m. in Edison. If you're in the New York area and you're interested, it's at Oratora and Edison. You can look at my latest farm blog post. I give the details there. Talk will be about some unusual Orthodox responses to the rise of Nazism, and Rabbi Yochanan Wasserman makes an appearance in there as well. Ah, Jay Kelman tells me that the RCA is asking people to translate. Thank you. YM is happy I'm setting the record straight. Not sure what record, but I appreciate it. Thank you. Ah, Dov tells me that Professor Asaf spoke at the Shloshim and spoke beautifully. And he was careful not to speak of Torah and Academy on that. Listen, David Asaf comes from, you know, a very fine Orthodox family, religious Zionist family. He's a Maskil. He became a Maskil. And the way he writes is like a beautiful Haskalah Hebrew. And his whole description of Haytham Henkin is really like a description of himself, his journey, and it's also a description of all the Maskilim. They all journeyed from the yeshivas to the wider open world. And that's, so he's portraying Haytham Henkin the same way he portrays all these Maskilim, when it's not that at all. Haytham Henkin, he's like a Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. You know, he grew up without he didn't go to one of these German Orthodox type schools in the land of Israel. I mean, he was 8 years, I think, in Kiryat Arba. This is like a Haredi yeshiva for the religious Zionists. You know, it's Torah and Torah only. And he has like a Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg journey or a Soloveitchik journey or something like that. It's not a Haskalah journey, far from it. And it's very nice that he didn't make the same mistake. I have to tell you, though, I mean, David Asaf, I learned a lot from him. But he just didn't get it. You see the comments, and he just doesn't get it. The word, you know, to waste your time on halacha, that's in the English translation, they didn't use the word waste, which is the translation of the Hebrew. They didn't use the word spend time. They used another word, which is a negative word. But okay. Let me just quickly finish up the, yes, thank you, David. So David was at the, Dov was at the Shiva. If you could tell me, Dov, I mean, were people shocked by what Rav Mazuz said? I mean, sitting there, I just don't. Part of the thing is us, that we're in the modern world. If Rav Mazuz spoke about Shabbos, no one would bat an eye. But we know the gay matter is touchy. And he, as a leader, I mean, he's a leader. He's not like one of these closed-minded people. He reads the paper every day. And in his new Tshuva, Derry team even mentions Madoff. I mean, he's very important. He knows what's going on in the world and how he misjudged that. It's all over the news, in English as well. And it just creates a bad, makes things look bad. YM says Rav Kook also criticized the Mizrahi. Of course he criticized the Mizrahi. David Asaf, yes. Thank you, YM. I didn't want, you know what, I was going to post something, but after Eitam's mother wrote an open letter there. You know, if the family is saying, we're not offended, don't write anything, I'm not going to go against. And that's when they closed the comments, the people who run the Sfarim blog. But that's not the way. It's just disrespectful to Torah to say that, he wasted his time. He moved into the academic world, no longer waste his time on Pilpulei Halacha. I mean, if that's not an insult, David Asaf just doesn't get it. Okay, I'm just going to wait to hear what Dov is typing, and then Dov says there was no reaction from the crowd. You don't think everyone knew who he was? Could be. Well, if they followed the elections, how could they not know who he was? His picture was up everywhere. The new Maran. I don't know. Okay, well, thank you all very much, and look forward to seeing you again next week. Good night, everyone. YM, I'm going to go now, but if you write it, it'll still be here next week. But good night, everyone.